Well, I apologise, you've got to listen to me croaking along. I've had about as much cough and throat medicine as I dare have. So we'll see how we get on. But we're continuing our series in Luke's Gospel, so please turn with me to the reading which we had. Now, as we've seen, chapter 20 is a chapter of question. Three times the religious leaders have come to Jesus with a question. It's been a question to catch him out. And three times, at Jesus' word, they've been thrown into confusion and retreat. Have you thought about that? A carpenter from Nazareth. A man in his early 30s. A man who's never moved very far from his home. And yet he leaves the greatest minds of his generation speechless. Here are consummate theologians, academic professionals. In terms of inquisitorial skills, here are the Jeremy Paxmans of their age. You better start to worry when they put you on the spot. But as they ask Jesus their questions, they find that it is they who are put on the spot. Who is this Jesus? No one's ever spoken like this man. No one. Who is he? And that's the question which Jesus will now ask them and us. So please have to in front of you chapter 20, verse 41, through to chapter 21. And verse 4, and we have 3 points. And point number one is a question of identity. Verse 41, and he said to them, how can they say that the Christ is the son of David? Now the Jews, scanning their Hebrew scriptures, understood that the coming one, the promised one, the Christ, that he would be the son of David. Well, what did that mean? Well, who's David? Well, 1,000 years before, David reigned in Jerusalem as king over Israel. And being king over the people of God, he reigned as God's viceroy, as God's representative on the earth. But of course, David died. What happened then? Well, the throne passed to his son, Solomon, the son of David. Well, what happened when Solomon died? Well, the throne passed to his son. And so each successive king, each successive son of David, held the throne in trust until the coming of the one to whom the throne belongs. The true king, the final king, the Christ, the son of David, who the Jews believed would reign as king in Jerusalem, who'd reign over a reborn Israel, no longer under the yoke of the Romans. On the contrary, the nations would now be subject to him, the son of David. It's all very neat. But does David himself agree? Does he, says Jesus? Is the Christ no more than David's descendant, David's son? Well, says Jesus, David doesn't seem to think so. What's this David writes in the book of Psalms, Psalm 110, verse 42, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. Now, if the Christ is David's descendant and no more, he should call David Lord. But he doesn't. David calls him Lord. The Lord said to my Lord. So how can the Christ be a descendant of David and at the same time be exalted over David? How can the father of the dynasty, David, be subordinate to his descendant, the son of David? Who can make sense of that? Talk about difficult questions. Compared to the ones that the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees have been asking, this is a real corker, this is a real sort of in-swinging yorker. It's unplayable, isn't it? A descendant of David, who David calls Lord. Who can make sense of that? Did you notice? Jesus doesn't give them the answer. He simply says, therefore David calls him Lord. How is he then his son? You're the theologians. Work it out. The same scriptures that teach that the Christ is David's son also teach that the Christ is David's Lord. Is he David's son? Is he David's Lord? How do you account for that? And Jesus is not trying to catch them out. He's asking a question which goes right to the heart of his identity. Now, who loves shopping at IKEA? Who loves negotiating that labyrinth? It never seems to come to an end, and you have to stop off halfway for some Swedish meatballs to keep you going. You've never seen a, whatever they call a storch before, but you think, well, you end up buying one. And a set of Gronders. Well, we bought a cabin bed. I don't know what it's called in Swedish. And I put it together. And I was going great, and it was looking very good. Till I had one piece that didn't fit. Where does this go? I looked at it and the holes were on the wrong side, or so it seemed to me. Was it surplus to requirements? No, I put the bed together the wrong way. This bit should have been there, and that bit should have been there. So down it all came, and this time, when I put it together, I included the missing bit. I'm sure you've all done that. Do you see? The Jews have taken their Hebrew scriptures to build a picture of the Christ, the Messiah, at least as they see him. It's all very neat. All seems to fit together. Yes, he's David's son. Until Jesus says, yes, but what about this piece? Where does that fit? Now, David himself said in the book of Psalms, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. Therefore, David calls him Lord. How is he then his son? How can he be David's descendant and at the same time be David's Lord? It doesn't fit in with your view, does it? Jesus saying, your view of Christ seems to be too small. His role too limited. He's not just David's son. He's David's Lord. The Lord said to my Lord. And he doesn't just sit upon the throne of Israel, he sits upon the throne of God. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand. Is he really going to sit as king in Jerusalem? God's throne is in heaven. So his rule, his lordship is much bigger than you think. Yes? And is he just going to subdue the nations? He must conquer all who oppose him. Everyone will confess that he is Lord. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. It's an allusion to Joshua and the Amorite kings. No need to turn to it, but it's spoken of in Joshua chapter 10. We read, then Joshua said, open the mouth of the cave and bring out those five kings to me from the cave. So it was when they brought those kings to Joshua, that Joshua called all the men of Israel and said to the captains of the men of war who went with him, come near, put your feet on the necks of these kings. And they drew near and put their feet on their necks. Then Joshua said to them, do not be afraid, nor be dismayed, be strong and of good courage, for thus the Lord will do to all your enemies against whom you fight. They come and they put their feet upon the necks of the kings. They make the necks of the kings their footstool. It's a picture of complete victory, isn't it? The Christ will put his feet upon the necks of his enemies. They will become his footstool. Even death, the last great enemy, will be crushed under his feet. So he really is Lord, isn't he? Sitting upon the throne of God. Sitting upon the throne of the universe, master over all. Isn't that interesting? Here are people who think they know the Bible, whose business is religion, and yet they have such small, such restricted views of who the Christ is. So Jesus, in effect, will you keep what you've put together? Or will you take it apart and include the missing piece so you have a full, accurate view of the identity of the Messiah? Some years ago on television, there was a three-part series called Jesus, The Evidence. He trumpeted that it was 2 years in the making. use the finest minds, modern theologians. And what conclusions have they come to? Who is the Christ? What is Jesus' identity? Well, among their suggestions is that he was a hypnotist, an occultist, a magician, a sexual deviant. And it goes on today, doesn't it? The God delusion. The Da Vinci Code. I know it's only fiction, but some people take it seriously. Do you see how careful we must be? Who is the Christ? Who is this Jesus? Well, who do you think he is? And we can be so sure, can't we, that we know, that we understand. We've even got verses from the Bible to show it. And our explanations are so neat. And all the times that Jesus, our thinking is so small. Our views of who this Jesus is, so restricted. And maybe we haven't even begun to understand the true dimensions of who this Christ is. Have you a true picture of his identity? Does this Jesus say yes, but what about this verse? A question of identity. So is he David's son? Yes. He's a descendant of David, born in David's city. He's the true king, the legitimate heir. He's a real man, flesh and blood, one of us. Except he's without sin. If I can say this carefully, we need never be afraid to approach him. Because he's a human being, like you and me. Is he David's Lord? Yes. He existed before David, before time, before anything was made that was made. In fact, he had no beginning. He's the uncreated. He's the second person of the Godhead. He's distinct. He's a person in his own right. The Lord said to my Lord. And yet if he's a distinct person, he is nevertheless God. And if we need ever be afraid to approach him, we nevertheless come in awe and wonder to one who is infinite, eternal, transcendent, to the one who is Lord. Do you see? David's son. David's Lord. To the divine nature was added a perfect human nature. He became what he had not been without ceasing to be what he was. Two natures, God and man, put together. One glorious person, the Lord Jesus Christ. And here's this carpenter from Nazareth. Again, these proud theologians, these professional thinkers, he's getting them to think outside the box. How can they say that the Christ is the son of David? Are you thinking outside the box? All the things that have come together to give you your view of who this Jesus is. Or maybe it's time you thought outside that box to ask real questions as to his identity. Well, in a few days' time, the Son of David will indeed be proclaimed king in Jerusalem. But not as might be expected. Will he be seated on a throne? No, he'll be nailed to a cross. And what will he write over his head? Luke says, "This is the King of the Jews." Here is great David's greater son. Here he is. And they've crowned him with thorns. And for a throne, they've nailed him to a cross. And he will die. It's at the end. 3 days later, he will rise. 40 days after that, he will ascend into heaven, where another psalm of David takes up the theme. Lift up your heads, O you gates, and be lifted up, you everlasting doors. It's the gates and doors of heaven. And the King of glory shall come in. And as he enters glory, past the ranks of angels and archangels, and as the praise of heaven thunders, we then hear the voice of the Father, "Sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool." Do you see what becomes of the rejected Christ? He's crowned Lord of all. And he sits at God's right hand. He sits on God's throne. In the very seat of deity sits the true man, in that place of honor and power and glory. Where is Jesus? Is he in a tomb outside Jerusalem? No, he reigns. He commands the universe. It's he who executes the eternal plan of God. And he's coming again to judge the world. His enemies will be made his footstool. He will place his feet upon the necks of his enemies. And every knee shall bow, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. The Lord said to my Lord, "Sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool." A question of identity. Who is he? 'Tis the Lord, a wondrous story. 'Tis the Lord, the King of glory. At his feet we humbly fall. Crown him, Lord of all. That's at point number 2. An unmasking. If Jesus raises questions to unmask his identity, he now unmasks the identity of these religious men. I wonder if people really thought about the scribes. Maybe they saw things that left them feeling uneasy. But then they dismissed the thought. After all, these are godly men. These are men who know the scriptures. These are men who are nearer to God than I will ever be. Blessed Jesus, are they? Jesus now unmasks these religious men. Verse 45, "Then in the hearing of all the people, he said to his disciples, 'Beware of the scribes, who desire to go around in long robes, love greetings in the marketplaces, the best seats in the synagogues, and the best places at feasts, who devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers. These will receive greater condemnation.'" At the Imperial War Museum at the moment, there's an exhibition on camouflage. It's the art of concealment. You find camouflage in nature, don't you? The other day we were at Kew, and there was a glass tank, and they said inside it was an insect that was disguised as a leaf, and there was some kid next to us saying, "Where is it? Where is it?" And exactly, where is it? It's in there somewhere. But you can't see it. It's disguised as a leaf. And of course the military have taken that and adopted that. In the First and Second World Wars, shipping was being attacked by submarines. How do you disguise a ship? It's a big thing, isn't it? In one sense, you can't disguise a ship. But you can paint a ship to break up its outline. And you can paint it in such a way as to confuse the submarine commander. Because if you paint the stern of the ship to look like the bow, then at least for a time as he's watching the ship, he doesn't know whether the ship is coming towards him or going away from him. Today, of course, they use stealth technology, don't they? You find it in nature, you find it in the military, and you find camouflage in the holiest of places. Here are God-fearing men, apparently, who are skilled in the art of concealment. They're not what they seem. They go around in long robes. It's a mark of their devotion to God. But verse 46 says Jesus, underneath the only devotion is that which they show to themselves. Especially if there's a free meal on offer. They make long prayers as a mark of their nearness to God. But verse 47, underneath their predators, exploiting the most vulnerable members of society, widows. Well, they might be able to fool the unwary. But Jesus tears off the mask. These men are hypocrites of the worst kind. They use the name of God They used the service of God to advance themselves. Instead of being faithful shepherds laying down their life for the sheep, they make sure the sheep lay down their life for the shepherds. Sheep mean wool and meat. For them, sheep mean fine clothing and a full stomach as they go, as it were, from one feast to the next. And therefore, says Jesus, for such men is reserved a particularly deep hell. Verse 47, these will receive greater condemnation. Well, what about today? A friend of mine spent some time in Zambia. Tells you one of the problems the churches face in Zambia is men who see the Christian ministry as a good career move. They see it as a stepping stone to political power. And so a man becomes a pastor because it's the quickest way to get a following. And once you've got a big church, once you've got a big following, you can then enter politics. How wicked. That was their real motive all along. To use the name of God. To get up the rungs of the ladder. To get some sort of power. To exert power over others. Do you have ambitions to serve the Lord? Then be happy to be a nobody. Be happy to be the servant of all. Be consumed with the only ambition that's worthy of a child of God. The ambition to live for God's glory. Christian friends, beware the scribe. He's in all of us. Is the person people meet in the pulpit, in the prayer meeting, in the public life of the church, is the person people meet in a crowd, the same person, your wife, your husband, your children, your family, meet in the home? I say, should give the answer. Let's put it another way. Is the person your friends see away from the church the same person that we see? Are you a saint here and a happy, cheerful sinner there? Are you a hypocrite? These will receive greater condemnation. As we close the second point, though, Jesus doesn't just unmask religious hypocrites, does he? There's a sense in which Jesus unmasks us all. What have we been learning in Luke? That there's no one like Christ. I can't stand long in the presence of Christ. I can't stand long in the presence of such holiness and goodness without realizing that he's different from me. That I'm not like him. I'm not like that. What am I then? By contrast, I'm a sinner. I'm a hypocrite. I'm a liar. I'm an adulterer. I'm a blasphemer. If when I look at him, that's what it means to love God with all my heart, then I've never loved God. If looking at him, I see that's what it means to love my neighbor as myself, then I've never loved my neighbor. And though these scribes may receive a greater condemnation, standing in the presence of Jesus, I am unmasked. I am condemned. There's no way I can prove my innocence on Judgment Day, is there? So either something's got to change, or he will place his feet on my neck. A question of identity, an unmasking, and point number three, a heart for God. This episode of The Widow's Two Mites, is it related to what's gone before? Is it just sort of an episode that sort of Luke's just parachuted in? It just sort of, there's a gap there, we'll put that episode in there. What do you think? Well, Jesus, having finished teaching in the temple courts, he now sits down in the court of the women. And we read chapter 21, verse 1, that he looked up. Well, in the court of the women, if you look up, what do you see? What did Jesus see? Well, he saw 13 brass containers shaped like trumpets with a narrow bit at the top. What were they for? Well, they were for the people's offerings. Every visitor who came to the temple would have put his money in one of these containers. Verse 1, he looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. Now, remember, this is first century Palestine. So there are no banknotes, no checks, no envelopes, no credit cards. All people have for offerings is cash in the shape of coins. So can you imagine the noise when a rich man puts his gift in the treasury? We jingle change in our pockets, don't we? Everyone would know that this was a rich man. You just have to listen to the sound of the offering as the coins go in. It's like a slot machine on payout as they all pour in through the thin neck and then out into the large trumpet-shaped bottom of the container. And imagine people turning to each other, can't you, saying, oh, that was a big offering. But how many people noticed this widow? Verse 2, and he saw also a certain poor widow putting in 2 mites. They're 2 very small copper coins. When she puts her offering in, there's hardly a sound. Mites, the tiniest of coins. It's less than the small change in a rich man's pocket. It's next to nothing, it's a pittance. If a man works for a day, he gets a denarius. If he works for 15 minutes, he would get 1 mite. Thought a man would earn in 15 minutes. It's next to nothing. No one would ever have heard those 2 tiny coins drop. But Jesus heard. Verse 3. So he said, truly I say to you that this poor widow has put in more than all. For all these out of their abundance have put in offerings for God. But she out of her poverty put in all the livelihood that she had. Says Jesus, this woman outgives them all. How come? All these rich people, they give a proportion of their wealth. She gives to God all that she has. They keep most of what they have back to spend on themselves. She gives all that she has to God. Their giving costs them nothing. Doesn't touch their standard of living. There's no real sacrifice involved when they give. This widow gives beyond her ability to give. For all these out of their abundance have put in offerings for God, but she out of her poverty put in all the livelihood that she had. So what does that tell you? Well, it tells you that unlike these rich people, God has this widow's heart. Having put herself on the altar as a living sacrifice, there's nothing that she would withhold from God. She's not discharging a religious duty. I've come to the temple. What do you do in the temple? Oh, yes, I better give my offering. This is an act of worship. This is an expression of her devotion. The God who has her heart has everything that she possesses, and she will gladly part with it in devotion to him. Isn't it a bit reckless? A penniless widow. Who's going to support her now? Or maybe she knows more about trusting her Heavenly Father for her daily bread than all of us. Her giving isn't mechanical. She knows that God doesn't need her money, but her giving is an expression of her relationship with God. She loves the Lord. Do you see why Luke has placed this account here? Verses 45 to 47, here are men who put their religion on show to advance themselves, and they're hypocrites. Here is an unnamed widow who is happy to be unseen except by her Father in heaven. It's all the difference between religion and a relationship. Which do you have? Let's close by pulling all 3 things together. Number 1. Jesus is Lord. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand And nothing can alter that fact. He sits upon the throne of heaven. Nothing can alter that. Least of all my rebellion. Number two, whether I'm a religious hypocrite or not, his life unmasks my life. He shows me up for what I am. A sinner. And unless I am reconciled to him, I will not escape his anger. And number three, what Jesus seeks is not the leftovers, having kept the best for ourselves. What does he want? He wants my life, my soul, my all. He wants to reign in my heart as my Lord. So does he? Is he asking too much? When he gave all that he had, when he gave himself to save rebel sinners like you and me, he gave himself. Who ever heard of a king giving his life to save his enemies? But then you see, this is the King of Love. Have you crowned him as your Lord? Will you crown him as your Lord? Or must you perish in his anger? Will you crown him? Then you must begin at the cross. Lord, I've sinned. You see it all. There's nothing I can hide from you. And before you, I'm naked, guilty, and therefore I'm ashamed. But you died on Calvary's tree. The king was crowned with thorns. He was nailed to a cross to save condemned sinners. So Lord, have mercy on this sinner. At his feet, humbly fall. Crown him. Crown him, Lord of all.